full of expectancy at the great spectacle to follow in what had been labelled the Reich Party Rally of Freedom. As in the previous 2 years, the narrow streets of Nuremberg's beautiful old town were thronged with party comrades, boys from the Hitler Youth, stormtroopers, and the black uniformed elite corps of the SS. Hitler's reception had been, as always, that of a conquering hero when he arrived in the city. The Zeppelinfeld to the southeast of the city, where Albert Speer's stadium, Congress Hall, and parade grounds, begun the previous year and set to accommodate over 300,000 persons, was still being built, was a sea of swastika flags lit at night with soaring searchlights. The scene captured Nazi aesthetics at their height. The tone of the rally had been set by Hitler's opening proclamation, read out as usual by Adolf Wagner. Hitler threatened that the fight against the inner enemies of the nation would never fail because of the formal state bureaucracy or its inadequacy. What the state could not solve would be solved through the party. And at the head of the list of internal enemies, he mentioned, stood Jewish Marxism. Exploiting attacks on National Socialism made at the Moscow Conference of the Comintern in the summer, the shrill assault on Jewish Marxism ran as a leitmotif throughout the rally. Preparations for the notorious laws which would determine the fate of thousands were little short of chaotic. Lösner and Medicus had arrived in Nuremberg on Saturday the 14th of September. The Reichstag meeting was scheduled for 8 p.m. the following day. There was little time for the already weary civil servants to draft the required legislation. Whatever the prior work on anti-Jewish legislation in the ministries of the Interior and Justice had been, it had plainly not passed the initial stages. No definition of a Jew had been agreed upon. The party were pressing for inclusion of Mischlinge, those of mixed descent, but the complexities of this were considerable. The work went on at a furious pace. During the course of the day, Lösner was sent more than once to battle his way through the huge crowds to Frick, staying at a villa on the other side of the city and showing little interest in the matter. Hitler, at Wagner's insistence, rejected the first versions Frick brought to him as too mild. Around midnight, Frick returned from Hitler with the order to prepare for him 4 versions of the Blood Law, varying in the severity of the penalties for offences against the law, and, in addition, to complete the legislative program to draft a Reich citizenship law. Within half an hour, they had drawn up, in the briefest of terms, a law distinguishing state subjects from Reich citizens, which only those of German or related blood were eligible to become. Though almost devoid of content, the law provided the framework for the mass of subsidiary decrees that in the following years were to push German Jews to the outer fringes of society, prisoners in their own land. At 2:30 a.m., Frick returned with Hitler's approval. The civil servants learnt only when the Reichstag assembled which of the 4 drafts of the Blood Law Hitler had chosen, possibly following the intervention of either Neurath or, more likely, Gertner. He had chosen the mildest. However, he struck out with his own hand the restriction to full Jews, adding further to the confusion by ordering this restriction to be included in the version published by the German news agency, Deutsches Nachrichtenbüro. Marriage and extramarital sexual relations between Jews and Germans were outlawed and to be punished with stiff penalties. Jews were also barred from employing German women under the age of 45 as servants. Hitler's speech, for him a remarkably short one, to the Reichstag on the 15th of September, recommending acceptance of the 3 laws, the flag law, the citizenship law, and the blood law, was the first time he had concentrated on the Jewish question in a major address since becoming Chancellor. Jews abroad, he declared, had been responsible for agitation and renewed boycotts against Germany. He blamed the Bolshevik revolutionary agitation following the Comintern Congress in Moscow and the insulting of the German flag in New York, when dock workers had torn down the swastika banner from the steamer Bremen, giving rise to an international incident on Jewish elements. The international unrest had stirred Jews within Germany to provocative action of an organized kind. If this were not to lead to uncontrollable defensive actions of the enraged population, there remained only the way of a legal regulation of the problem. The German government was therefore, Hitler went on, persuaded by the idea of being able, through a once-and-for-all secular solution, of perhaps creating a basis on which the German people might possibly be able to find a tolerable relationship with the Jewish people. From one whose first written political statement in 1919 had specified that the final aim of government policy must be the removal of the Jews altogether, and had made a political career out of his vitriolic hatred of the Jews, this was blatant deception aimed at the outside world. The threat, always near at hand for Hitler, followed immediately. Should the hope not be fulfilled and international agitation continue, the situation would have to be re-examined. He sharpened the threat in a menacing remark in recommending the Blood Law. This, he said, was the attempt at a legal regulation of a problem which, in the event of further failure, would then have through law to be transferred to the final solution of the National Socialist Party. This was a hint of Hitler's true feelings about radical measures on the Jewish question. But the reason, alongside propaganda advantages, why Hitler had been prepared to bow to the pressure to introduce the anti-Jewish legislation so hastily, was apparent in further comments he made that evening. After Göring, as Reichstag president, had formally introduced the laws, and they had received the unanimous vote of the delegates, Hitler returned to the podium. He appealed to the delegates to see to it that the nation itself does not depart from the rule of law, and that this law is ennobled by the most unprecedented discipline of the entire German people. In his fourth speech of the day, this time to party leaders, Hitler once more underlined the significance of the laws and renewed his command to the party to desist from every individual action against Jews. The Nuremberg Laws, it is plain, had been a compromise adopted by Hitler, counter to his instincts, to diffuse the anti-Jewish agitation of the party, which over the summer had become unpopular not merely in wide sections of the population, but, because of its harmful economic effects, among conservative sections of the leadership. The compromise did not please party radicals. It was a compromise, even so, which placated those in the party who had been pressing for legislation, especially on racial defilement. And in putting the brakes on agitation and open violence, it had nevertheless taken the discrimination on to new terrain. Disappointment among activists at the retreat from a direct assault on Jews was tempered by the recognition, as one report put it, that the Führer had, for outward appearances, to ban individual actions against the Jews in consideration of foreign policy, but in reality was wholly in agreement that each individual should continue on his own initiative the fight against Jewry in the most rigorous and radical form. The dialectic of radicalization in the Jewish question in 1935 had been along the following lines: pressure from below, green light from above, further violence from below, breaks from above assuaging the radicals through discriminatory legislation. The process had ratcheted up the persecution several notches. The Nuremberg Laws served their purpose in dampening the wild attacks on the Jews which had punctuated the summer. Most ordinary Germans, not among the ranks of the party fanatics, had disapproved of the violence, but not of the aims of anti-Jewish policy, the exclusion of Jews from German society, and ultimately their removal from Germany itself. They mainly approved now of the legal framework to separate Jews and Germans as offering a permanent basis for discrimination without the unseemly violence. Hitler had associated himself with the search for a legal solution. His popularity was little affected. The thorny question of defining a Jew had still to be tackled. Since Hitler had ruled out the restriction of the Blood Law to full Jews, civil servants in the Ministry of the Interior were left to struggle for weeks with party representatives in an attempt to reach agreement about the extent of partial Jewishness needed to qualify under the law. Drafts of the first implementation ordinances under the Reich Citizenship Law, legally defining a Jew, were formulated to try to comply with Hitler's presumed views. But although Hitler intervened on occasion, even on points of minute detail, his sporadic involvement was insufficient to bring the tug of war between Hess's office and the Ministry of the Interior to a speedy end. The ministry wanted to classify as Jews only those with more than two non-Aryan grandparents. The party, with Reich Doctors leader Wagner applying pressure, insisted on the inclusion of quarter Jews. Numerous meetings brought no result. Meanwhile, without awaiting a definition, some ministries were already imposing a variety of discriminatory measures on those of mixed background using different criteria. A decision was urgently necessary, but Hitler would not come down on one side or the other. A decision was expected when he addressed a meeting of Gauleiter in Munich, to which Stuckart and Lösner were invited on the 24th of September. However, Hitler contented himself with a discourse on the need to ensure the purity of German blood through the measures planned for implementation under the citizenship law, then deviated into what Goebbels called a monumental foreign policy preview. The definition of a Jew would, he said, have to be worked out between the party and the Ministry of the Interior. The key question had been left unanswered. Jewish question still not decided, noted Goebbels on the 1st of October. We debate for a long time about it, but the Führer is still wavering. By early November, with still no final solution in sight, Schacht and the Reichsbank Directorate, claiming the uncertainty was damaging the economy and the foreign exchange rate, joined in the pressure on Hitler to end the dispute. Hitler had no intention of being pinned down to accepting security of rights for Jews under the legislation, as the Reichsbank wanted. The prospect of open confrontations between party representatives and state ministers of the Interior, Economics and Foreign Affairs, and likely defeat for the party, at a meeting scheduled for the 5th of November to reach a final decision, made Hitler call off the meeting at short notice. He was looking for a compromise. "Führer now wants a decision," wrote Goebbels on the 7th of November. "Compromise is in any case necessary and absolutely satisfactory solution impossible." A week later, the first supplementary decree to the Reich citizenship law finally ended the uncertainty. Wagner got his way on most points, but on the definition of a Jew, the Ministry of the Interior could point to some success. Three-quarter Jews were counted as Jewish. Half-Jews, with two Jewish and two Aryan grandparents, were reckoned as Jewish only if practicing the Jewish faith, married to a Jew, the child of a marriage with a Jewish partner, or the illegitimate child of a Jew and Aryan. A compromise, but the best possible one, was how Goebbels described the outcome. His distaste was evident. "Quarter Jews over to us, half Jews only, in exceptional cases, in the name of God, so that we can have peace. Slickly and unobtrusively launch in the press, not make too much noise about it." Whatever Goebbels's personal reservations, there was some sense in playing it down, for the definition of a Jew had ended with a contradiction recognized by the Ministry of the Interior. For legislative purposes, it had been impossible to arrive at a biological definition of race dependent on blood types, so it had been necessary to resort to religious belief to determine who was racially a Jew. As a result, it was possible to imagine descendants of pure Aryan parents converted to Judaism who would thereby be regarded as racial Jews. It was absurd, but merely highlighted the absurdity of the entire exercise. The approach of the Winter Olympics in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, then the Summer Games in Berlin, along with the sensitive foreign policy situation, meant that the regime was anxious to avoid any repetition of the violence of the summer of 1935. For the next 2 years, though the wheel of discrimination carried on turning, the Jewish question was kept away from the forefront of politics. When Wilhelm Gustloff, the leading NSDAP representative, Landesgruppenleiter in Switzerland, was assassinated by a young Jew in February 1936, the circumstances did not lend themselves to wild retaliation. Frick, in collaboration with Hess, strictly banned individual actions. Hitler restrained his natural instinct and confined himself to a relatively low-key generalized attack on Jewry at Gustloff's funeral. Germany remained quiet. The absence of violence following Gustloff's murder is as clear a guide as the outrages in the anti-Jewish wave of 1935 to the fact that the regime could control, when it wanted to, the pressures for action within the ranks of the party radicals. In 1935, it had been useful to encourage and respond to such pressures. In 1936, it was opportune to keep them in check. For Hitler, whatever the tactical considerations, the aim of destroying the Jews, his central political idea since 1919, remained unaltered. He revealed his approach to a meeting of party district leaders at the end of April 1937 in immediate juxtaposition to comments on the Jews. "I don't straightaway want violently to demand an opponent to fight. I don't say fight because I want to fight. Instead, I say I want to destroy you. And now let skill help me to manoeuvre you so far into the corner that you can't strike any blow, and then you get the stab into the heart." In practice, however, as had been the position during the summer of 1935 before the Nuremberg rally, Hitler needed to do little to push forward the radicalization of the Jewish question. By now, even though still not centrally coordinated, the Jewish question pervaded all key areas of government. Party pressure at headquarters and in the localities for new forms of discrimination was unceasing. Civil servants complied with ever tighter constraints under the provisions of the Reich citizenship law. The law courts were engaged in the persecution of Jews under the provisions of the Nuremberg laws. The police were looking for further ways to hasten the elimination of Jews and speed up their departure from Germany. And the general public, for the most part, passively accepted the discrimination where they did not directly encourage or participate in it. Antisemitism had come by now to suffuse all walks of life. The Nazis have indeed brought off a deepening of the gap between the people and the Jews, ran a Zopade report from Berlin covering the month of January 1936. The feeling that the Jews are another race is today a general one. 4. In one of the 17 speeches he made at the 1935 party rally in Nuremberg, Hitler attempted, he was speaking after all to the party faithful, to disclaim the evident wide disparity between his own massive popularity and the poor image of the party. "I must take a stance here against the comment so often heard, especially among the bourgeoisie, 'The Führer, yes, but the party, that's a different matter.' To that I give the answer, 'No, gentlemen, the Führer is the party, and the party is the Führer.'" Since the mid-1920s, the identity of leader and party had been a myth that had served both well. It had given the party a cohesion and discipline otherwise notably lacking, and it had established Hitler's supreme power base as the sole keeper of the party's grail. But however necessary Hitler's attempts to uphold the myth were, the reality was that once in power, the popular images had inevitably diverged. Hitler, by late 1935, was already well on the way to establishing, backed by the untiring efforts of the propaganda machine, his standing as a national leader, transcending purely party interest. He stood for the successes, the achievements of the regime. Within 3 years, his genius, so propaganda proclaimed and so the majority of the population believed, had masterminded economic recovery, the removal of the scourge of unemployment, and, even by ordering the shooting of his own SA leaders, the re-establishment of law and order. He had, it seemed, also single-handedly broken the shackles of Versailles, restored military pride, and made Germany once more a force to be reckoned with in international affairs, and all the time skilfully avoiding conflict and upholding Germany's peaceful aims. There was nothing specifically Nazi about his achievements. Any patriotic German could find something to admire in them. His popularity soared accordingly also among those who were otherwise critical of National Socialism. With the party, it was a different matter. Where Hitler seemed to represent national unity, the party functionaries were all too often seen as corrupt, high-handed and self-serving, sowing discord rather than embodying the spirit of the national community. The party could be, and often was, blamed for all the continuing ills of daily life, for the gulf between expectations and reality that had brought widespread disillusionment in the wake of the initial exaggerated hopes of rapid material improvement in the Third Reich. Not least, the party's image had badly suffered through its attacks on the Christian churches. As in the Jewish question, much of the impetus came from the party's grassroots and local or provincial leadership. The long-standing antagonisms built up in the time of struggle before 1933 were not easy to contain now that the party held power. The attack on the autonomy of the provincial Protestant churches in Bavaria and Württemberg provided one notable flashpoint. The deposition in autumn 1934 by Reich Bishop Ludwig Müller, implemented with strong-arm tactics by his henchmen, of the popular bishops Meiser and Würm, who headed the resistance to incorporation of these independent churches in the coordinated new creation of a Reich Church, had led to mass unrest among some of National Socialism's most loyal supporters. The pious peasantry of Franconia, one of the NSDAP's bastions, bitterly blamed the party. Hitler escaped the opprobrium. Personal loyalty to him was untouched. When he intervened in late October to reinstate Meiser and Würm, it seemed yet another indication that he had been kept in the dark by his subordinates, intervening to restore justice once he realized what was taking place without his approval. His intervention had in fact been a capitulation to popular pressure, a necessary step to end the unrest and limit the damage being done. His emollient assurances to Meiser and Würm, contrasted with his angry denunciation of them a few months earlier as traitors to the people, enemies of the fatherland, and the destroyers of Germany. Among the Catholic population, too, the continued war of attrition against church practices and institutions undermined the position, never as strong as in Protestant regions, of the NSDAP and its representatives in solidly Catholic areas. Hitler again escaped much of the blame. His popularity was certainly not left unscathed, but it was easier and less dangerous to criticize the local party functionaries or the bogeyman, usually singled out by church leaders as the most pernicious anti-Christian radical, Alfred Rosenberg. Concerned at the growth of unrest caused by the church struggle, especially with vital issues in foreign policy still unsettled, Hitler told Goebbels in the summer of 1935 that he wanted peace with the churches, at least for a certain period of time. He took the question of Catholicism, noted Goebbels, very seriously. But as with the Jewish question, the radicals at the party's grassroots and in its leadership were not so easily controlled. The church struggle in Catholic areas intensified, and by the winter of 1935-6, morale in such regions plummeted. The dismal mood in those parts of the country worst affected by the assault on the churches was only part of a wider drop in the popularity of the regime in the winter of 1935-6. Hitler's personal standing was still largely untouched, but even the Führer was increasingly being drawn into the criticism. For a regime, and its leader quite especially, which had built a doctrine on erasing the consequences of November 1918 and ensuring that no future people's rising could take place, the manifestations of unrest could not be ignored. Hitler was aware of the deterioration in the political situation within Germany and of the material conditions underlying the worsening mood of the population. Führer gives an overview of the political situation, sees a decline, registered Goebbels in mid-August. A summary of price and wage levels prepared for Hitler on the 4th of September 1935 showed almost half of the German workforce earning gross wages of 18 Reichmarks or less per week. This was substantially below the poverty line. The statistics went on to illustrate that a family of five, including three children of school age, existing on the low wage of even 25 Reichmarks a week, earned by a typical urban worker, and living on an exceedingly frugal diet, could scarcely be expected to make ends meet. Wages then remained at the 1932 level, substantially lower than the last pre-depression year of 1928 in the much maligned Weimar Republic. Food prices, on the other hand, had risen officially by 8% since 1933. Overall living costs were higher by 5.4%. Official rates did not, however, tell the whole tale. Increases of 33%, 50%, and even 150% had been reported for some foodstuffs. By late summer, the terms food crisis, Ernährungskrise, and provisions crisis, Versorgungskrise, were in common use. Dwindling currency reserves and a chronic shortage of foreign exchange had already led in 1934 to Schacht being given near dictatorial control over the economy. His new plan of September that year had imposed strict controls on allocation of foreign exchange for imports and aimed to reorientate Germany's foreign trade through bilateral agreements with countries in southeastern Europe, essentially obtaining supplies of raw materials on credit set against subsequent exports of finished goods from Germany. The problems, however, continued. The priority given to rearmament made them unavoidable. Noticeably rising armaments expenditure and expensive imports, given a refusal to entertain any consideration of currency devaluation, were creating inevitable difficulties. It was becoming impossible to provide both the imports of raw materials needed for the expanding armaments industry and the imports of foodstuffs required to keep down consumer prices. A bad harvest in 1934 and a combination of inefficiency, mismanagement and over-bureaucratization in Daré's Reich food estate further exacerbated the structural economic problem. The production battle, Erzeugungsschlacht, trumpeted by Daré in November 1934, had, despite reducing imports, begun with some misplaced bureaucratic intervention by the Reich food estate. The result was a serious shortage of domestic fodder, falling livestock herds, and a vicious circle of food shortages. By the autumn of 1935, reserves of fats and eggs had been almost entirely used up. But foreign exchange for imports could only be at the expense of industry, and primarily armaments manufacture. All at once, it seemed, the food shops were empty. Queuing for food became part of a dismal daily routine in the big cities. Fats, butter, eggs, then meat became scarce and expensive. Farmers, with their usual public-spirited support for the national community, held back their produce to maximize profits. Standards of living, already depressed in the big cities, fell sharply. The industrial working class, the section of society treated with most suspicion and caution by the regime and worst hit by the food crisis, was especially disaffected. The Berlin police reported a serious deterioration in the mood of the population in autumn 1935 as a result of the fats and meats shortage, rising food prices, and renewed growth in unemployment. There was great anger among those queuing for food. Butter sales had to be watched over by the police. There was ill-feeling towards hoarders. But most ill-feeling was directed at the government, which had proved incapable of controlling prices. The situation was even worse in some other big cities. After all, the capital had been singled out for favorable treatment. By January 1936, a further deterioration had set in. The mood among a shockingly high percentage of the population in Berlin was said to be directly negative towards state and movement. Criticism was now moving into uncontrollable territory. Income and food prices stood in crass disproportion to each other. Rises in food prices, 70% in the case of frozen meat, were the main source of unrest. Reality stood in contradiction to official declarations about the situation. Food stalls in the markets of Moabit and Charlottenburg were hotbeds of discontent. Communist sentiments could be heard and were apparently falling increasingly on ready ears. By March, the mood prompted great worry. There was marked bitterness in wide sections of the population. The Heil Hitler greeting had largely vanished. There was a lot of talk of a second 30th of June, the night of the long knives, bringing a military dictatorship and a fundamentally new and clean state leadership and administration under the dominant influence of the armed forces. The food shortages had highlighted the enormous gulf between the poverty of the masses and the ostentatious wealth and blatant corruption of party bosses. Hitler himself came under fire for tolerating such a situation. Confidence of the population in the person of the Führer is also undergoing a crisis, claimed the report of the Berlin police. The mood in the people is not bad, but good. I know that better. It's made bad through such reports. I forbid such things in future, raged Hitler, when his adjutant, Fritz Wiedemann, tried drawing the accounts of low morale to his attention. But such an irrational response itself hinted that Hitler had a good impression of how the material shortages had affected the popularity of his regime. He was, in fact, fully in the picture of the seriousness of the situation. He had been made well aware, as early as September 1934, of complaints from the poorer sections of society about the price of fat products. Daré was asked whether the complaints were justified and had to supply information on the price trends for milk and fats. This was followed by a number of top-level discussions involving the party's Gauleiter, with Hitler himself present on one occasion. 2 months later, Hitler ordered the appointment of Karl Gordeler, Lord Mayor of Leipzig, as Reich Commissar for Price Surveillance. Hitler had, he told a meeting of ministers on the 5th of November 1934, given the working class his word that he would allow no price increases. Wage earners would accuse him of breaking his word if he did not act against the rising prices. Revolutionary conditions among the people would be the further consequence. He would not, therefore, allow the shocking driving up of prices. Gordeler's position, however, had more to do with appearances than with any actual power to prevent the price rises. By July 1935, Frick was sending copies of worrying reports from all parts of the country to the Reich Chancellery. He urgently requested that Hitler be made aware of the serious danger they illustrated of the impact the rising prices was having on the working class. The trustees of labor, meeting in Berlin on the 27th of August, painted the same picture. Hitler demanded the statistical report on prices and income levels, which we have already noted. The report of the 4th of September showed poor living standards, falling real wages, and steep price increases in some necessities. This was the dismal reality behind the fine facade of the Third Reich. Hitler was told later in the month of the implications of the food shortage for the rearmament program. The minimum from the critically depleted reserves of foreign exchange needed to import fats, especially cheap margarine, to overcome the shortages was estimated at 300,000 Reichmarks per day, and even this was well below what Darré was wanting. There was no doubt what this meant. All foreign exchange expended for fats provisions has, as a consequence, a drop in raw material imports and therefore increased unemployment. But even this must be accepted, for the provisioning of the population with fatstuffs must take precedence over all other needs. Rearmament had, for the time being, to take second place. By then, Schacht had already warned the Gauleiter in Hitler's presence that only 5 milliard Reichmarks were available for armaments, and that he would have to introduce cuts. Otherwise, the whole thing will collapse. Price Commissar Gordeler wanted more than a temporary reordering of the priority given to rearmament. In a devastating analysis of Germany's economic position sent to Hitler towards the end of October 1935, he regarded the satisfactory provisioning of the population with fats, even in relation to armaments, as having political priority. He favored a return to a market economy, a renewed emphasis upon exports, and a corresponding reduction in the rearmament drive, in his view, at the root of the economic problems. The only alternative, he apocalyptically proclaimed, was the return to a non-industrial economy with drastic reductions in the standard of living for every German. If things carried on as they were, only a hand-to-mouth existence would be possible after January 1936. The prognosis was anathema to Hitler. For Gordeler, it marked the beginning of the path that led eventually into outright resistance. His more immediate response, however, was to recommend the winding up of the Reich Commissariat for Price Surveillance, since, in his view, it served no useful purpose. On both occasions, the suggestion was made in November 1935 and again in February 1936. Hitler refused, plainly to retain appearances, to entertain the dissolution of the Price Commissariat until further notice. Meanwhile, Hitler had intervened in October to ensure that Schacht made available an additional sum of 12.4 million Reichmarks in precious foreign exchange for the import of oilseed for margarine production. Goering, his first sally into the economic domain, up to now rigidly in Schacht's hand, was deployed by Hitler to arbitrate between Schacht and Darré in the fight for foreign exchange. He came down on the side of Darré, a decision that took Schacht and some business leaders by surprise. But for Hitler, the immediate prime need was to avoid the damaging psychological effects of the only alternative, food rationing. The press agency was confidentially informed in November of the Führer's decision that the card for fats should not be introduced and that instead sufficient currency for the import of foodstuffs should be made available by the economics minister. Rearmament was affected. The war ministry was prepared to forego until spring some of its allocation of foreign exchange so that foodstuffs could be imported. Popular unrest was directly impinging on the regime's absolute priority. Hitler had cause for concern. As the domestic problems deepened, however, the Abyssinian crisis, causing disarray in the League of Nations, presented Hitler with new opportunities to look to foreign policy success. He was swiftly alert to the potential for breaking out of Germany's international isolation, driving a further deep wedge between the Stresa signatories and attaining, perhaps, a further revision of Versailles. Given the domestic situation, a foreign policy triumph would, moreover, be most welcome. Already in August, he had expressed eager anticipation of what he saw as a certain war about to take place in Abyssinia. He outlined in Goebbels's presence how he saw foreign policy plans developing. With England, eternal alliance, good relationship with Poland, expansion to the east, the Baltic belongs to us, conflicts, Italy, Abyssinia, England, then Japan, Russia, imminent. Within a few years would arrive our great historic hour. We must be ready then. Grandiose perspective, added Goebbels, we're all deeply moved. Less than 2 months later, with the Italian war in Abyssinia now a reality, Goebbels recorded Hitler's view, expressed to ministers and army leaders that everything is coming for us 3 years too soon. He emphasized, however, the opportunity that Germany now faced. Rearm and get ready. Europe is on the move again. If we're clever, we'll be the winners. But the rearmament drive was now seriously threatened by the food crisis. In spring 1936, Hitler again personally intervened in the face of Schacht's bitter objections to allocate Dare once more scarce foreign currency, 60 million Reichmarks on this occasion, for the import of seed oil. The armament's position was becoming desperate. Schacht had to explain to Blomberg in December that an increase in raw material imports was out of the question. By early 1936, available supplies of raw materials for rearmament had shrunk to a precariously low level. Only 1 to 2 months' supplies were left. Schacht demanded a slowdown in the pace of rearmament. As Hitler entered his fourth year as Chancellor, the economic situation posed a real threat to rearmament plans. At the very time that international developments encouraged the most rapid expansion possible, the food crisis and the social unrest it had stirred were sharply applying the brakes to it. Other indicators were also discouraging. Fears of a new rise in unemployment seemed likely to be borne out. In January 1936, the Reich Labour Ministry was gloomily reporting unemployment still running at around 2.5 million, with, it seemed, little prospect of a further lasting reduction. Any slowdown in rearmament, as Goerdeler and Schacht were advocating, would inevitably bring increased unemployment in its train. Politically, the problems of the winter had given new life to the underground KPD, while reports from within the NSDAP repeatedly emphasized the poor morale and low spirits of party members. It was little wonder that Hitler and other Nazi leaders had been seriously concerned about the possible consequences of a lasting period of food shortages, rising prices, and social tension, both for domestic stability and for foreign policy ambitions. Almost 2 years later, he would remark that a renewed food crisis without adequate foreign exchange to master it would amount to a waning point, Schwächungsmoment, of the regime. He saw this as all the more reason to hasten expansion to gain living space. In early 1936, too, domestic as well as foreign policy considerations almost certainly played a part in the timing of Hitler's next big gamble, to destroy what was left of the Versailles and Locarno treaties by reoccupying the demilitarized Rhineland. Certainly that was the view of Foreign Minister Neurath, speaking to Ulrich von Hassel, German ambassador in Rome, who had been urgently summoned for the second time within a few days to Berlin on the 18th of February to discuss the Rhineland question. Neurath was of the opinion that for Hitler, in the first instance, domestic moves were decisive, maßgebend. Hitler, he went on, felt the deterioration of mood in favor of the regime and was looking for a new national slogan to fire the masses again. The usual election, alongside a plebiscite, would be the way, the foreign minister presumed. Hitler himself spoke openly of his domestic motives at a meeting with Hassel that evening, describing how he wanted to couch his appeal both abroad as well as to his own nation. Weeks later, Hassel remained sure that domestic considerations had been dominant in Hitler's mind, and that the timing to coincide with Heroes' Memorial Day on the 8th of March had been determined in order to maximize the propaganda effect. Hitler needed no convincing of the domestic advantages and propaganda capital to be gained from a dramatic national triumph. It would certainly offer an opportunity to deflect from the problems of the previous winter, the food crisis, the escalating church struggle. The sagging morale could be dispelled overnight, the regime's position strengthened at home as well as abroad, Hitler's own popularity still further enhanced. In the Rhineland itself, where reports had been painting a dismal picture of especially unfavorable economic conditions, and where clashes between the party and the Catholic Church were seriously undermining support for the regime, never specially strong in this area, the abolition of the demilitarized zone through unilateral German action was certain of a rapturous welcome, a step which could unquestionably, as the foreign ministry knew, have been accomplished through patient diplomacy within a year or two, was then undertaken with all the risk and drama of a military coup, at least in part because of the notable propaganda gains Hitler saw to be made from a sudden coup. As Neurath had foreseen, the elections and plebiscite immediately called for the 29th of March underlined the domestic considerations involved. The masses could be reinvigorated, sagging morale among the party membership dispelled, activists again given activity. As on other occasions, domestic and foreign policy considerations were closely intertwined in Hitler's thinking. The domestic advantages would not have weighed so heavily had not international circumstances, framed by the Abyssinian crisis, opened up an opportunity to strike, which Hitler felt he could not miss. 5. Under the terms of the 1919 peace settlement, the German Reich had been prohibited from erecting fortifications, stationing troops, or undertaking any military preparations on the left bank of the Rhine and within a 50-kilometer strip on the right bank. The status of the demilitarized Rhineland had subsequently been endorsed by the Locarno Pact of 1925, which Germany had signed. Any unilateral alteration of that status by Germany would not only amount to a devastating breach of the post-war settlement and reneging on an international agreement, it would also threaten the very basis of Western security which that settlement had endeavored to establish. From a German nationalist perspective, however, the current status of the Rhineland was intolerable. The remilitarization of the Rhineland would have been on the agenda of any German nationalist government. The army viewed it as essential for the rearmament plans it had established in December 1933 and for Western defense. The foreign ministry presumed the demilitarized status would be ended by negotiation at some point. Diplomats were aware that it would have been done away with when Germany introduced military service, had not caution prevailed because of its anchorage in the Locarno Pact as well as the Versailles Treaty. Hitler had talked confidentially of the abolition of the demilitarized zone as early as 1934. He spoke of it again in broad terms in summer 1935. By the end of the year, the French were reckoning that they would soon face a fait accompli in the Rhineland. Hitler referred in a meeting with the British ambassador on the 13th of December to the need to end the demilitarized zone, saying he regretted not having taken the step along with the introduction of conscription the previous March. Around that time, Hitler discussed with his military advisers the problems that might arise from reoccupying the zone. The opportunity was by then beginning to present itself. However likely the reoccupation would have been within the next year or two, the seizing of that opportunity, the timing and character of the coup, were Hitler's. They bore his hallmark at all points. The opportunity was provided by Mussolini. As we have noted, his Abyssinian adventure, provoking the League of Nations' condemnation of an unprovoked attack on a member state, and the imposition of economic sanctions, broke the fragile Stresa front. Italy, faced with a pessimistic military outlook, sanctions starting to bite, and looking for friends, turned away from France and Britain towards Germany. The stumbling block to good relations had since 1933 been the Austrian question. Since the Dollfuss assassination in mid-1934, the climate had been frosty. This now swiftly altered. Mussolini signaled in January 1936 that he had nothing against Austria in effect becoming a satellite of Germany. The path to the Axis immediately opened up. Later the same month, he publicly claimed the French and British talk of possible joint military action against Italy in the Mediterranean, not that this was in reality ever likely, had destroyed the balance of Locarno and could only lead to the collapse of the Locarno system. Hitler took note. Then, in an interview with Ambassador Hassel, Mussolini indicated that, for Italy, Stresa was finally dead, and that in the event of sharper sanctions, Italy would leave the League of Nations, thereby effectively killing the Locarno Agreement. He acknowledged to Hassel that Italy would offer no support for France and Britain should Hitler decide to take action in response to the ratification of the Franco-Soviet Mutual Assistance Pact, currently before the French Chamber of Deputies, and viewed by Berlin as a breach of Locarno. The message was clear. From Italy's point of view, Germany could re-enter the Rhineland with impunity. The Abyssinian crisis had also damaged Anglo-French relations and driven the two democracies further apart. This was particularly the case after the storm of protest, once news had leaked out in December 1935, of the proposed Hoare-Laval plan, named after Sir Samuel Hoare and Pierre Laval, the British and French foreign ministers, rewarding Italy's aggression in a foretaste of what would happen in a different context at Munich in 1938 by offering it two-thirds of Abyssinian territory. The French government realized that a move to remilitarize the Rhineland was inevitable. Most observers tipped autumn 1936, once the Olympics were out of the way. Few thought Hitler would take great risks over the Rhineland when conventional diplomacy would ultimately succeed. Ministers rejected independent military action against flagrant German violation. In any case, the French military leadership, grossly exaggerating German armed strength, had made it plain that they opposed military retaliation and that the reaction to any fait accompli should be purely political. The truth was, the French had no stomach for a fight over the Rhineland, and Hitler and the German Foreign Office sensed this. Soundings had also led Hitler and Neurath to a strong presumption that Britain too would refrain from any military action in the event of a coup. They saw Britain as, for the time being, weakened militarily, preoccupied politically with domestic affairs and with the Abyssinian crisis, unwilling to regard the preservation of the demilitarization of the Rhineland as a vital British interest, and possessing some sympathy for German demands. The chances of success in a swift move to remilitarize the Rhineland were therefore high. The likelihood of military retaliation by France or Britain relatively low. That was, of course, as long as the assessment in Berlin of the likely reactions of the European powers was correct. Nothing was certain. Not all Hitler's advisers favored the risk he was increasingly prepared to take without delay, but Hitler had been proved right in his boldness when leaving the League of Nations in 1933 and reintroducing conscription in 1935. He had gained confidence. His role in the Rhineland crisis was still more assertive, less than ever ready to bow to the caution recommended by the military and diplomats. Rumors were rife in Berlin at the beginning of February that Hitler was planning to march troops into the Rhineland in the near future. Nothing at that point had been decided. Hitler pondered the matter while he was in Garmisch-Partenkirchen for the opening of the Winter Olympics on the 6th of February. He invited objections, particularly from the Foreign Office. During February, he discussed the pros and cons with Neurath, Blomberg, Fritsch, Ribbentrop, Göring, then with Hassel, the ambassador in Rome. A wider circle within the Foreign Office and military leadership were aware of the pending decision. Fritsch and Beck were opposed. Blomberg, as usual, went along with Hitler. Foreign Minister Neurath also had grave doubts. He thought speeding up the action was not worth the risk. Though it was not likely that Germany would face military retaliation, further international isolation would be the result. Hassel also argued that there was no hurry, since there would be future chances to abolish the demilitarized zone. Both were of the view that Hitler should at least await the ratification of the French-Soviet Pact by the Senate in Paris. This, as an alleged breach of Locarno, was to serve as the pretext. Hitler preferred to strike after ratification by the Chamber of Deputies without waiting for the Senate. Whatever the caution of the career diplomats, Hitler was, as always, egged on in the most unctuous fashion by the sycophantic Ribbentrop. Hitler told Hassel that the reoccupation of the Rhineland was, from a military point of view, an absolute necessity. He had originally had 1937 in mind for such a step, but the favorable international constellation, the advantage of the French-Soviet pact, given the anti-Soviet feeling in Britain and France, as the occasion, and the fact that the military strength of the other powers, especially of the Russians, was on the increase and would soon alter the military balance, were reasons for acting sooner, not later. He did not believe there would be military retaliation. At worst, there might be economic sanctions. At discussions on the 19th of February, Hassel argued that the change for the better in Italy's fortunes in Abyssinia and the dropping of oil sanctions had lessened the chances of Italian support. Hitler countered by stressing the disadvantages of delay. Attack, in this case too, he characteristically argued, to lively assent from Ribbentrop, was the better strategy. He would use the Franco-Russian pact as a pretext and offer a seemingly generous package, continuation of the demilitarized zone on both sides, a three-power air pact, and non-aggression pact with France to the Western powers. There was little chance that it would prove acceptable. Hassel had even before this already formed the view that Hitler was more than 50% determined to act. The skeptical Fritsch also thought, by the middle of the month, that the decision had been taken. Neurath was by this time also resigned to the move, whatever his reservations. But Hitler continued to waver. His arguments had failed to convince the diplomats and military leaders. The sycophantic Ribbentrop was in favor, Blomberg nervously supportive. Otherwise, the advice he was receiving favored caution, not boldness. This was the case as late as the end of February. However determined Hitler was on an early strike, the precise timing still had to be decided. On the 27th of February, remilitarizing the Rhineland was the topic at lunch. Goering and Goebbels had both joined Hitler. "Still somewhat too early," summed up Goebbels. The following day, Hitler remained undecided. Goebbels advised him to wait till the Russian pact is perfect, meaning until it had been ratified by the French Senate. Later that day, Goebbels accompanied Hitler to Munich, discussing the Rhineland question on the train. "The Führer, still wavering, unschlüssig," noted Goebbels in his diary. He himself continued to argue for a delay until the Senate's ratification. There would be further talks next day before Hitler would decide. At lunch, on the 29th of February, he had yet to make up his mind. But the following day, Sunday the 1st of March, with Munich bathed in beautiful spring-like weather, Hitler turned up at the hotel where Goebbels was staying in a good mood. The decision had been taken. "It's another critical moment, but now is the time for action," wrote Goebbels. "Fortune favors the brave. He who dares nothing wins nothing." The next day, the 2nd of March, Goebbels attended a meeting in the Reich Chancellery at 11 a.m. The heads of the armed forces, Goering, Blomberg, Fritsch, and Raeder, were there, so was Ribbentrop. Hitler told them he had made his decision. The Reichstag would be summoned for Saturday the 7th of March. There, the proclamation of the remilitarization of the Rhineland would be made. At the same time, he would offer Germany's re-entry into the League of Nations, an air pact, and a non-aggression treaty with France. The acute danger would thereby be reduced, Germany's isolation prevented, and sovereignty once and for all restored. The Reichstag would be dissolved, and new elections announced with foreign policy slogans. Fritsch had to arrange for the troop transport during Friday night. "Everything has to happen as quick as lightning." Troop movements would be camouflaged by making them look like SA and Labour Front exercises. The military leaders had their doubts. Members of the cabinet were informed individually only on the afternoon of the following day, Frick and Hess as late as the evening. By then, invitations to the Reichstag had already gone out, but to keep up the deception, only to a beer evening. By Wednesday, Hitler was working on his Reichstag speech. Goebbels was already preparing the election campaign. Warning voices from the foreign ministry could still be registered on the Thursday. By Friday evening, Hitler had completed his speech. The cabinet met to be informed for the first time collectively of what was planned. Goebbels announced that the Reichstag would meet at noon the next day. The only item on the agenda was a government declaration. Plans for the election campaign were finalized. Workers in the propaganda ministry were not permitted to leave the building overnight to prevent any leaks. "Success lies in surprise," noted Goebbels. "Berlin trembles with tension," he added next morning. The Reichstag too was tense as Hitler rose amid enormous applause to speak. The Kroll Opera, where the Reichstag still met, close to the ruins of the building that had burned down in 1933, was packed to the rafters. Hundreds of pressmen filled the galleries. Numerous diplomats were present, though the English and French ambassadors, guessing what was coming, had stayed away. On the platform, among the members of the cabinet, Blomberg was visibly white with nerves. None were visible in Goering, sitting behind Hitler and looking about to burst with pride. Goebbels read a typed copy of the speech as Hitler spoke. The deputies, all in Nazi uniform, still did not know what to expect. The speech was aimed not just at those present in the Kroll Opera, but at the millions of radio listeners. After a lengthy preamble denouncing Versailles, restating Germany's demands for equality and security, and declaring his peaceful aims, a screaming onslaught on Bolshevism brought wild applause. This took Hitler into his argument that the Soviet-French pact had invalidated Locarno. He read out the memorandum which Neurath had given to the ambassadors of the Locarno signatories that morning, stating that the Locarno Treaty had lost its meaning. He paused for a brief moment, then continued. Germany regards itself, therefore, as for its part, no longer bound by this dissolved pact. In the interest of the primitive rights of a people to the security of its borders and safeguarding of its defense capability, the German Reich government has therefore from today restored the full and unrestricted sovereignty of the Reich in the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland. At this, wrote William Scheirer, witnessing the scene, the 600 Reichstag deputies, little men with big bodies and bulging necks and cropped hair and pouched bellies and brown uniforms and heavy boots, little men of clay in his fine hands, leaped to their feet like automatons, their right arms upstretched in the Nazi salute, and scream, "Heils!" When the tumult eventually subsided, Hitler advanced his peace proposals for Europe. A non-aggression pact with Belgium and France, demilitarization of both sides of their joint borders, an air pact, non-aggression treaties, similar to that with Poland, with other eastern neighbors, and Germany's return to the League of Nations. Some thought Hitler was offering too much. They had no need to worry, as Hitler knew there was not the slightest chance of his offer proving acceptable. He moved to the climax. Men, deputies of the German Reichstag, in this historic hour, when in the western provinces of the Reich German troops are at this moment moving into their future peacetime garrisons, we all unite in two sacred inner vows. He was interrupted by a deafening tumult from the assembled deputies. They spring, yelling and crying to their feet, William Scheirer recorded. The audience in the galleries does the same, all except a few diplomats and about 50 of us correspondents. Their hands are raised in slavish salute, their faces now contorted with hysteria, their mouths wide open, shouting, shouting, their eyes burning with fanaticism, glued on the new god, the Messiah. The Messiah plays his role superbly. Patiently he waited for silence. Then he made the two vows, never to yield to force when the honor of the people was at stake, and to strive for better understanding with Germany's European neighbors. He repeated his promise of the previous year that Germany had no territorial demands to make in Europe. But outside Germany, trust in Hitler's word was beginning to wear thin. Around 1 p.m., just as Hitler was reaching the high point of his peroration, German troops approached the Hohenzollern Bridge in Cologne. Two planeloads of journalists, handpicked by Goebbels, were there to record the historic moment. Word had quickly got round Cologne that morning. Thousands packed the banks of the Rhine and thronged the streets near the bridge. The soldiers received a delirious reception as they crossed. Women strewed the way with flowers. Catholic priests blessed them. Cardinal Schulte offered praise to Hitler for sending back our army. The church struggle was temporarily forgotten. The force to be sent into the demilitarized zone numbered no more than 30,000 regulars, augmented by units of the Landespolizei. A mere 3,000 men were to penetrate deep into the zone. The remainder had taken up positions for the most part behind the eastern bank of the Rhine. The forward troops were to be prepared to withdraw within an hour in the event of likely military confrontation with the French. There was no chance of this. As we have seen, it had been ruled out in advance by French military leaders. French intelligence, counting SA, SS and other Nazi formations as soldiers, had come up with an extraordinary figure of 295,000 for the German military force in the Rhineland. In reality, one French division would have sufficed to terminate Hitler's adventure. Had the French then marched into the Rhineland, Hitler was reported to have commented more than once at a later date, "We would have had to withdraw again with our tails between our legs, mit Schimpf und Schande."